Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Stephen Sound, and it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA and New York Times best-selling author of The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. As a scientist and conservationist, Dr. Diamond's field expeditions have taken him around the world. He spent the early part of his career in New Guinea and neighboring islands, where he studied ecology and the evolution of birds. Dr. Diamond is a founding Society of Conservation Biology board member and also serves on the board of directors of the World Wildlife Fund and Conservation International. He has also been elected to all three leading scientific academic honorary societies, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. For his academic and scientific research, Dr. Diamond has won numerous awards, including the prestigious MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and the National Medal of Science. He's the best-selling author of several books, including Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Diamond earned his undergraduate degree from Harvard and his PhD in physiology and biophysics from the University of Cambridge. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Jared Diamond.
Let me first check whether you'll be able to hear me okay and back. Can you hear okay? It's a great pleasure for me to be back in the Silicon Valley area, which I first visited after growing up in Boston and on the East Coast about 48 years ago, and that helped convince me that I was on the wrong coast. And so I moved now to Los Angeles, but it's a special pleasure to be here today, because in the audience are friends whom I've known since birth and friends, other friends that I've met not at their birth, but nearly 50 years ago. So it's good to be with you today. To give me an idea of how many of you will find what I'm going to say today of practical use, I'd like to ask you to raise your hands in response to either of two questions. First, let me ask you to raise your hands if either you are over age 65 or hope to live past 65 or have a parent or grandparent who did live past 65. Raise your hand, please. Okay, those of you who just raised your hands, you will find what I'm going to say today of practical value. Now, let me ask you to raise your hand if you are less than 65, have no intent of living past 65, and have no parent or grandparent who cleared 65. Raise your hands, please. Okay, we've got at least a couple. For those couple of you, what I'm going to say today will be of no practical value, but you'll nevertheless find it fascinating. I'm going to talk about growing older in traditional societies. This subject constitutes just one chapter of my latest book, which compares traditional small tribal societies with our big modern societies with respect to many aspects of society, such as status of old people, bringing up children, health, dealing with danger, settling disputes, war, religion, and speaking more than one language. Tribal societies, which constituted all human societies for most of human history, are far more diverse than are our modern big societies. Every big society that has a government, and where most people are strangers to each other, all those big societies are similar to each other, and they're different from tribal societies in many basic ways, regardless of whether our big societies are American, German, Chinese, or Israeli. Tribes constitute thousands of natural experiments in how to run a human society. They constitute experiments from which we ourselves may be able to learn. tribal society shouldn't be scorned as primitive and miserable, but also they shouldn't be romanticized as happy and peaceful. When we learn of tribal practices, some of them will horrify us, but there are other tribal practices which, when we hear about them, we may admire and envy and wonder whether we could adopt those practices ourselves. To get some perspective on how we treat elderly people in modern Western society, let me tell you the opinion of a friend of mine from the Fiji Islands in the Pacific Ocean who had visited the U.S. There were some things that my Fiji friend admired about the U.S., other things that he disliked, but what he most loathed about the U.S. was our treatment of older people. He almost shouted at me indignantly, "You Americans throw away your older people." By that he meant that most old people in the U.S. end up living separately from their children and separately from most of their friends of their earlier years, and often they live in separate retirement homes for the elderly. Whereas in Fiji and other traditional societies, older people instead live out their lives among their children, their other relatives, and their lifelong friends. Nevertheless, the treatment of the elderly varies enormously among traditional societies, from much worse to much better than in our modern societies. At the worst extreme, many traditional societies get rid of their elderly in one of five increasingly direct ways. The most indirect method to get rid of an old person is just to neglect the person and not to feed him or clean him until he or she dies. The second method is to abandon older people when the group moves on. The next method is to encourage older people to commit suicide. A fourth, more direct method is to kill older people with their own cooperation. For example, among the Kaolong people of Papua New Guinea, when a man dies, his widow asks her brothers or her sons to strangle her. The fifth and most direct method of getting rid of the elderly is to kill them without their consent or cooperation. In what tribal societies do children abandon or kill their old parents? It happens mainly under two conditions. One is in nomadic hunter-gatherer societies that often shift camp and that are physically incapable of transporting old people who can't walk when the able-bodied younger people already have to carry their young children and their other physical possessions. The other condition is in societies living in marginal or fluctuating environments, such as the Arctic or deserts, where there are periodic food shortages, and occasionally there just isn't enough food to keep everybody alive. Whatever food is available has to be reserved for able-bodied people capable of contributing to the tribe's survival and to the children who will grow up to be the tribe's future adults. To us modern Americans, it sounds horrible to think of abandoning or killing your own sick husband or wife or your own elderly mother or father. But what else could those societies do? They face a cruel dilemma. Their older people had to do it to their own parents, and the older people know what now is going to happen to them. At the opposite extreme in treatment of the elderly, the happy extreme, are the New Guinea farming societies where I've been doing my field work for the last 50 years, and the village society, my Fijian friend, and other sedentary traditional societies around the world. In those societies, older people are cared for, they remain valuable, and they continue to live in the same hut or a nearby hut near their children, relatives, and lifelong friends. There are two main sets of reasons for this variation among societies in their treatment of older people. The variation depends especially on the usefulness of older people and on the society's values. First, as regards usefulness, older people may continue to perform useful services in traditional societies just as in our modern societies. One use of older people in traditional societies is that often they're still effective at producing food. Another traditional usefulness of older people consists of babysitting their grandchildren, thereby freeing up their own adult children, the parents of those grandchildren, to go hunting and gathering food for the grandchildren. Another traditional use of older people is in making tools, weapons, baskets, pots, and textiles. In fact, older people are usually the ones who are best at it. older people usually are the leaders of traditional societies and the people most knowledgeable about medicine, religion, politics, song, and dances. That's the origin of our expression, tribal elders. To some extent, that's still true today. The average age of American presidents on assuming or reassuming the presidency is 54 years. Finally, older people in traditional societies have one more huge significance that would never occur to us in our modern literate societies, where our sources of information are books and newspapers and the internet. In contrast, in traditional societies without writing, older people are the repositories of information. Their knowledge is what spells the difference between survival and death for the whole society in a time of crisis caused by rare events of which only the oldest people alive have had experience. Those, then, are the ways in which older people are useful to traditional societies. Their usefulness varies among traditional societies and contributes to variation in the society's treatment of the elderly. The other set of reasons for variation in treatment of the elderly is the society's cultural values, which vary somewhat independently of the usefulness of the elderly. For example, among large societies that have had centralized governments for thousands of years, there's particular emphasis on respect for the elderly in East Asia, associated with the philosophy of Confucius and his doctrine of filial piety, which means obedience, respect, and support for elderly parents. Cultural values that emphasize respect for older people, such as filial piety, contrast with the low status of the elderly in the United States. Older Americans, for example, are at a disadvantage in getting jobs. A sociologist at Boston University carried out the experiment of submitting dozens of job applications in response to ads by prospective employers. All of the applications gave fictitious names of women, and all of the applications were identical, except that half of the applications gave the woman's age as 25 to 40, and the other half gave her age as 45 to 60. The result of the experiment was that employers were twice as likely to call a woman age 25 to 40 for a job interview as a woman age 45 to 60. Another example of the low status of the elderly in the U.S. is an explicit policy in our hospitals called age-based allocation of health care resources. That expression is a cruel euphemism. It means that if hospital beds are limited, if hospital resources are limited, for example, if there's only a certain number of hospital beds available, or if only one donor heart becomes available for transplant, or if the surgeon has time to operate only on a certain number of patients today, American hospitals have an explicit policy of giving preference to younger patients over older patients on the grounds that younger patients are considered more valuable to society because they have more years of life ahead of them, even though the younger patients have fewer years of valuable life experience behind them. There are several reasons for this low status of the elderly in the United States. The high status of the elderly in East Asia is based on the Asian emphasis on filial piety, but the low status of elderly Americans arises from several American values that replace filial piety. One is our Protestant work ethic, which places high value on work, so older people who are no longer working aren't respected. Another reason is our American emphasis on the virtues of self-reliance and independence, so that we instinctively scorn older people who are no longer self-reliant and independent. Still, a third reason is our American cult of youth, which shows up even in our advertisements. Ads for Coca-Cola and beer always depict smiling young people, even though old people as well as young people buy and drink Coca-Cola and beer. Just think, what is the last time that you saw a Coca-Cola or a beer ad depicting smiling people 75 or 80 years old? Never. Instead, the only American ads featuring white-haired old people are ads for retirement homes and ads for pension planning. Well, what has changed in the status of the elderly today compared to their status in traditional societies? There have been a few changes for the better and more changes for the worse. Big changes for the better include the facts that today we enjoy much longer lives, much better health in our old age, and much better recreational opportunities. Another change for the better is that we now have specialized retirement facilities and programs to take care of old people. Changes for the worse begin with the cruel reality that we now have far more old people and relatively far fewer young people than at any time in the past. That means that all those old people are more of a burden on the few young people, and that each old person has less individual value. Another big change for the worse in the status of the elderly is the breaking of social ties with age, because older people, their children, and their friends all move and scatter independently of each other many times during their lives. The typical American moves every 5 years on the average. Hence, our older people are likely to end up living away from their children and from the friends of their youth. Yet another change for the worse in the status of the elderly is formal retirement from the workforce, carrying with it a loss of work relationships and a loss of the self-esteem associated with work. Perhaps the biggest, though, of all the changes for the worse in the status of our elderly is that they've objectively lost much of their usefulness that they had in traditional societies. Widespread literacy means that they are no longer useful as repositories of information. When we want some information, we look it up in a book or we Google it instead of finding some old person to ask. Finally, the slow pace of technological change in traditional societies means that what someone learns as a child in a traditional society is still useful when that person is old. But the rapid pace of technological change today means that what we Americans learn as children is no longer useful 60 years later. And we older people are not fluent in the technologies essential to surviving in modern American society. For example, as a 15-year-old high school student, I was considered outstandingly good at multiplying numbers because I had memorized the two-digit multiplication tables, and I know how to use logarithms, and I'm quick at manipulating a slide rule. Today, though, skill at multiplication tables and logarithms and slide rules is utterly useless because any idiot can multiply eight-digit numbers accurately and instantly with a pocket calculator. Conversely, I, at age 75, am incompetent at skills essential for everyday American life. My family's first television set that we acquired in 1948 had only three knobs that I quickly mastered. There was an on-off switch, there was a volume knob, and there was a channel selector knob. Today, just to watch a television program on the television set in my own house, last Sunday when I wanted to watch the San Francisco 49ers play the Atlanta Falcons, I had to operate a 41-button TV remote that I still find utterly confusing. To watch the 49ers against the Falcons, I had to telephone my 25-year-old sons and ask them to talk me through it while I tried to push those wretched, impossible 41 buttons. What can we do to improve the lives of the elderly in the U.S. and to make better use of their value? That's a huge problem. In my remaining few minutes today, I can offer you just a few suggestions. One value of older people is that they are increasingly useful for offering high-quality, inexpensive child care. As more and more younger women enter the workforce and as fewer young parents stay home as full-time caretakers of their children. Compared to the usual alternatives of paid babysitters and daycare centers, grandparents offer superior, motivated, experienced, cheap child care. They've already gained experience from raising their own children. They usually love their grandchildren, and they're eager to be permitted to spend time with their grandchildren. Unlike other caregivers, grandparents are unlikely to quit their job because they found another job with higher pay and more Social Security medical care benefits. A second value of older people is paradoxically related to their loss of value as a result of changing world conditions and technology. At the same time, older people have gained in value today precisely because of their unique experience of former conditions that have now become rare because of rapid change, but that might come back. For example, only older Americans, now in their 70s or older today, can remember the firsthand experience of living through a Great Depression, the experience of living through a world war, the experience of living through food and gas rationing, and the experience of debating whether or not dropping atomic bombs would be more horrible than the likely consequences of not dropping atomic bombs. Most of our current voters and leaders and politicians have no personal experience of any of those things, but millions of older Americans do. Unfortunately, all of those terrible situations could come back. Even if they don't come back, we have to be able to plan for them on the basis of experience of what they were like. Older Americans have that experience. Younger Americans don't have that experience. The remaining value of older people that I'll mention involves recognizing that while there are many things that older people can no longer do, there are other things that they are much better at doing than our younger people. A challenge for society is to make use of those things that older people are better at doing. Some abilities, of course, decrease with age. Those include abilities at tasks requiring physical strength and stamina, ambition, and the power of novel reasoning in a narrowly circumscribed situation, such as figuring out the structure of DNA best left to scientists under the age of 30. Conversely, valuable attributes that increase with age include experience, understanding of people and human relationships, ability to help other people without your own ego getting in the way, and interdisciplinary thinking about large databases, such as biogeography and comparative history, best left to scholars over the age of 60 or preferably over the age of 75. Hence, older people are better than younger people at supervising, administering, teaching, advising, strategizing, and synthesizing. I've seen this value of older people with so many of my friends in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s, friends who are still active at those ages as farmers, lawyers, surgeons, and teachers. In short, many traditional societies make better use of their elderly and give their elderly more satisfying lives than we do in modern big societies. Paradoxically, nowadays, when we have more elderly people than ever before, living healthier lives and with better medical care than ever before, old age is in some respects more miserable than ever before. The lives of the elderly are widely recognized as constituting a disaster area of modern American society. We can surely do better by learning from the lives of the elderly in traditional society. What's true of the lives of the elderly in traditional societies is true of many other features of traditional societies as well. Of course, I'm not advocating that we all give up agriculture and metal tools, return to a hunter-gatherer stone tool lifestyle, live in small tribes, and resume making war against and killing people in neighboring tribes. There are many obvious respects in which our lives today are far happier than those of small traditional societies. To mention just a few examples, our lives today are longer, materially much richer, and less plagued by violence than are the lives of people in traditional societies. But there are also things to be admired about people in traditional societies, and perhaps to be learned from them. Their lives in traditional societies are usually socially much richer than are our lives, although materially poorer. Their children in traditional societies are usually more self-confident, more independent, more socially skilled, more precocious than are our children. They in traditional societies essentially never die of diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, and the other non-communicable diseases that will be the causes of death of most of us in this room today. That's not because people in traditional societies don't live long enough to get diabetes and those other diseases. Even when you make comparisons at the same age, people living traditional lifestyles are far less likely to get diabetes and heart disease and those other non-communicable diseases than are Americans of the same age. Features of the modern lifestyle predispose us to those diseases, and features of the traditional lifestyle protect us against them. Other chapters in my book, besides the chapter on aging, discuss other areas of traditional societies that have influenced me and for which I think many of us can learn. There's a chapter on dispute resolution, which in traditional societies aims at emotional reconciliation and emotional clearance. Whereas any of us who've been involved in proceedings in American civil courts or criminal courts know what the American court system is concerned about is right and wrong, and emotional clearance and emotional reconciliation play no role whatsoever with the result that our courts commonly end up with, the result that divorcing couples and brothers and sisters locked in inheritance dispute never want to speak to each other for the rest of their lives. Child rearing plays out differently in traditional societies and modern societies, and there are surprises there. The value of traditional methods of transporting babies, not horizontally in the baby carriage, not vertically facing backwards, but vertically facing forwards. That means that the baby sees the same field of view as the person carrying the baby and develops more sense of being in control and faster development in neuromotor skills. There's quicker responses to infants crying. In traditional societies, if an infant cries, the caretakers or the parents deal with the infant, pick up or comfort the kid within 10 seconds at most, often within 3 seconds, whereas a widespread view in modern societies is that if the baby's crying when it's go to sleep, let it cry for 10 minutes or 30 minutes. Great way to foster a sense of security. Alternative parent models. In Western society, in American society, parenting is overwhelmingly the responsibility of the parents. In traditional societies, parenting is the responsibility of every adult in the village. And so there are all these pseudo-aunts and uncles, which means far more social models from whom the kids can learn. Attitudes towards danger are different in New Guinea from how they are in the United States. New Guineans, if they have an accident, don't have police, 911, or doctors to bail them out, and so they have to learn to think clearly about dangers. We Americans obsess about the wrong dangers. We obsess about terrorists and plane crashes, which really are going to affect very few of us, and we fail to pay attention to the significant dangers of life, particularly for older people, slipping in the shower, on the sidewalk, on a stepladder, on the stairs, car accidents, other crazy drivers. There's a chapter on the evolution of religion, which has changed functions from traditional to modern societies, and that may be useful in trying to figure out what's going to be the future of religion in the next century. And there's a chapter on multilingualism, which in the United States is controversial, to put it mildly. There's, in fact, strong resistance in the U.S. to raising kids bilingually, but in traditional societies, essentially every kid is raised multilingually because mother and father are likely to speak different languages than kids in neighboring societies. Perhaps one of the most surprising results of work on my book was a discovery of the last few years that let's put it this way, Alzheimer's disease, that feared dementia of old age, there's no effective protection against Alzheimer's disease. All the discussion of bridge and Sudoku, no evidence for it, until within the last few years it was discovered that the only useful protection we know of is to be bilingual or multilingual. Bilingual or multilingual people get on the average 5 years of protection against symptoms of Alzheimer's, even for a given level of organic brain lesions. Well, those are just some examples of what we can learn from traditional societies. I hope that you'll find it as fascinating to read in my book about traditional societies as I found it to live in them. That's all that I wanted to say formally, and now I think Steve will come MC and pose questions, and then I have my signing pens, and I'll be glad to sign books afterwards.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Diamond, for those fascinating insights. We have a number of questions here from the audience, and including one who would like to know, how do traditional societies define things like happiness, success, progress, and, you know, how those differ from contemporary Western definitions?
How do traditional societies define happiness, progress? I have not heard anyone in a traditional society define happiness. And scholars, there's an economist at USC who has made his career out of defining happiness, and it's controversial. As for progress, In traditional societies, the rate of what we would call technological change is so infinitely slow that I've not encountered a concept of progress.
So in a related question, one of the audience members here wants to know how traditional societies define risk, which you talked some about. But I was wondering if you could go into that more, because you have some fascinating stories that you cover in the book from your own experiences, ranging from crops to your own boat accident.
The big difference in conception of risks in traditional societies and in our modern American society is that my New Guinea friends and people in traditional societies generally recognize the significance of things that you will do very often, but each time you do them, the risk is low. And so we Americans tend to poo-poo those risks. For example, I survived today the most dangerous thing that I'm going to do all day today. I took a shower. What's the risk of a shower? You may say, well, the risk of falling, but you say, well, my chances of falling in a shower are 1 in 1,000. Okay, just read the obituary column of any newspaper and you'll see that a common cause of either death or crippling of older people is slipping in the shower, stepladder, et cetera. And you may say, I'm careful. My risk of falling in the shower is 1 in 1,000. Well, I'd say that's not remotely good enough. At age 75, statistically, I have another 15 years of life ahead of me, which means 5,475 more showers. And if my risk of falling in the shower is 1 in 1,000, that means that I'm going to kill myself 5 times between now and my statistical lifespan. You've got to reduce the risk far below 1 in 1,000. So New Guineans think care. They don't think about showers. They instead think about trees falling over on them, which are a significant risk in New Guinea life.
Well, can you follow up on that in your discussion about crops and yield? Because that's a wonderful part of the book where you look at the risk of crop failure in one particular plot and the role that statistics or some other kind of knowledge might play and how traditional societies have dealt with risk in that way.
Sure. Most of us have probably read in high school about medieval peasants in Europe having a strip system where a peasant did not have one block of land but had 7 strips scattered in 7 different places, and it would commonly say how stupid that is. The peasant has to walk between 7 different strips. Why don't they just amalgamate their strips? Well, there was an anthropologist doing a study in Highland Peru where these potato farmers in Peru scattered their strips, and they would have typically about 15 different strips of land, all of them tiny. And an agricultural expert came in and said, how stupid, how mind-blowingly stupid these peasants are. They should just trade and amalgamate their land. But it turns out that if you've got 15 strips in different directions, the risk of an insect blight or of people stealing your stuff or of a frost varies in different directions. And so if you've got 15 strips, what the peasants care about is making sure that their potato yields never drop to the point where they'll starve. And if you put all your potatoes in one big block, yes, you don't have to walk back and forth, and your yield averaged over 50 years may be higher. But in 17 of those 50 years, you would have starved to death. Whereas if your strips are scattered in many different directions, then the chances are, then you can virtually guarantee that in any year, at least some of those strips will produce.
So one of the other aspects that you talk about in the book in drawing the comparisons between contemporary societies and traditional societies is the way that, especially in psychology, that perceptions are gained from weird societies, which is a wonderful term to unpack, and how that skews what our sense of the larger world is and what is human nature.
Weird. We all know what weird is, but a group of sociologists coined the term weird, W-E-I-R-D, as an acronym for Western, Educated, Industrial, Rich, and Democratic. Any of you who've read any journal of psychology, experimental psychology, you know that the subjects for psychological experiments, they're always American college undergrads was between age 18 and 21, usually majoring in psychology. But that's rather a narrow database, and so-called cross-cultural studies, studies of psychology, which compare Americans with Israelis, Argentinians, and Chinese. You could think, terrific, very cross-cultural. Every one of those is a society with a state government and centralized and industrial rich, and most of them democratic. So what that indicates is that our modern society are just a very tiny slice of human cultural diversity. There's far more diversity among all those traditional societies because every modern society, whether it's Argentinian, Chinese, or American, once you have a state government and once people have to deal with strangers, you get necessarily convergence.
So here's someone who wants to know, how many languages do you speak and what are they?
At one time or another, I've spoken or read 13 languages. So, but today, the only languages in which I can hold a speech, give a speech today, are English, German, Italian, and Neo-Melanesian. In the past, I was fluent in French, Spanish, and Russian, but I'm rusty. Indonesian, I can make my way. Latin, Greek, I used to be good at reading. Dutch, I can read a bit, but I've never spoken it. And Finnish and a New Guinea language called the Foray language, I could say elementary things, but I'm out of shape.
So what's the future of geographers, this person wants to know, in an age of climate change?
What is the future of geographers in an age of climate change? Or what is the future of geographers in American society where the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans no longer protect us, and where countries that used to be considered utterly inconsequential for American well-being, such as Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, have now become of interest to us, although the majority of Americans cannot locate Iraq, Afghanistan, or Somalia on the map, and although studies by the National Geographic Society show that Americans rank 12th out of 13 among major nations in knowledge of geography, and that most Americans cannot locate on the map, not only can't they, have they not the faintest idea where's Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, but most Americans cannot locate New York City, fair enough, but the biggest feature, geographic feature on the globe is the Pacific Ocean. If you close your eyes and point, you are more likely than not to hit the Pacific Ocean, but most Americans cannot locate the Pacific Ocean. So what's the future of geography in this area of climate change? It's recognized that where you are has a big influence on your life, has a big influence on a society. The U.S. Intermontane West is getting drier and hotter, and that's bad for agriculture in the Intermontane West. The U.S. Southeast is getting warmer and wetter, and that's good for agriculture in the U.S. Southeast. That's not because Montanans are stupid and Alabamans are very bright. It's entirely because of geography. And the result of that is that geography departments that went through a nadir in the United States over the last several decades because of our belief that geography is a matter of memorizing state capitals, geography departments are now back on the rise again. Stanford, to my great regret, does not have a geography department, but that great institution, UC Berkeley, does.
All right, go Bears. Okay. Well, here's someone who wants to know, they say taking, in Guns, Germs, and Steel, you link the failure of some people to develop the wheel to the ability to domesticate beasts of burden. I, this person says, have moved lots of dirt with a wheelbarrow. Why didn't this tool come first?
Interesting question. Why didn't a wheelbarrow precede domestic animals and carts? The fact is that the wheelbarrow was invented in China a couple of thousand years ago, long after animal domestication. We can only speculate. Any wheel requires something rather new. It requires figuring out an axle. And the wheels that we have today are, when you think of it, rather complicated. The wheel has a rim, and it's got spokes, and then it's got the axle itself. Well, that sort of wheel was not invented because it takes many intermediate steps to get there. The first wheels of 3000 BC were solid. No rim, no spokes. They were solid, but they had an axle. And those big, heavy wheels obviously were not used for wheelbarrows. They were used to pool carts drawn by oxen and eventually horses. And eventually, a couple of thousand years later, the Chinese then modify those big, solid wheels to become the axle, single wheel of a wheelbarrow. So that's the history of the wheelbarrow.
So here's someone who wants to know, will our so-called civilization survive the 21st century?
Good question. Will our so-called civilization survive the 21st century? As a father of 25-year-old children, that's something that my wife and I debated before we decided whether we were going to have children at all. Would we want to launch our children into a world that wasn't worth living in? And I'd say that the chances are, I go back and forth, but today I would say the chances are 51% that our civilization will survive the 21st century and 49% not. But the good news is that what might prevent us from surviving is all stuff that we ourselves are doing. The risk isn't an unstoppable asteroid hurtling into us, but it's things that we are doing, such as fossil fuels and toxic chemicals and unsustainable forest and fisheries policies. So because we are making the problems, we can also choose to stop making the problems.
What about the death of languages? Is that something that can be reversed? Because that's something that you go into in a number of places in the book.
Can death of languages be reversed? Sure, it can be reversed, and there are languages whose death has been reversed. An outstanding example is Hebrew, which is now the national language of Israel, although Hebrew was barely a spoken language for 2,000 years. There are other spoken languages that are coming back in North America. The Cherokee are doing well at bringing back the Cherokee language. The Eyak language of Alaska, the last native speaker from birth of this Native American language, Eyak language, died about half a dozen years ago. But fortunately, a New York linguist made tape recordings of the Eyak language. And so after the death of the last native speaker, young Eyaks are now relearning the Eyak language. And one has to ask, so what about, who cares whether all these languages are disappearing? At the rate at which we're going now, 95% of the world's languages will be gone by the end of this century. Why do we care? Well, language serves as the anchor of culture. When you lose language, you lose culture. Language is also the medium of literature. Well, one might say, well, we can read literature in translation. Yes, you can read literature in translation, but Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be, if we are going to converge on the world's biggest language, then let's carry that to the extreme. The world's biggest language is Mandarin. Who cares whether we lose English language? Well, I think most of us here would say there's some advantage to being able to read Hamlet To Be or Not to Be in English rather than in Mandarin translation.
So you mentioned your sons, and one of the wonderful lines you have in your book has to do with when you became a father, and looking at yourself in comparison to a 14-year-old girl in New Guinea, and who had just become a mother. And you say, at age 14, she was better qualified to be a parent than I had been when I became a father at age 49. All right, wondering if you can tell that, because that's a wonderful way of comparing the roles in the different societies.
Sure. Americans, when they become parents, often or usually have little experience in dealing with children. And so they get books and they consult their pediatricians on the subject and they read different philosophies and they talk to their friends and they get all this theoretical training and then they're handed this screaming baby and what do you do with a screaming baby? Whereas in New Guinea, older siblings take care of their younger siblings. Kids play in groups. 14-year-olds play with the 2-year-olds. And so by the time a New Guinean becomes 14 or 16 years old, they've been looking after younger siblings for their entire lives. And so the reality, when I saw this, I was really taken aback to see this 14-year-old girl whom I'd met when she was 12 years old. And here I come back and she's now 14 and she has a baby. But then I reflected, the reality is that she's become a mother with far more experience in dealing with children than I did when I became a father at age 50.
And at the other end of the spectrum, here's someone from the audience that mentions that you've discussed age-based allocation of resources in healthcare, but it is widely believed that the bulk of one's healthcare expense is spent during the last 2 weeks of one's life. What can we learn from traditional society about their fair and loving use of scarce resources?
Difficult, boy, difficult question. I think that's a point at which I should say difficult question and let you all wrestle with it, because there's no happy answer to that question.
What about... what about... Well, let's swing back to the beginning of the spectrum again, because you use another wonderful analogy in talking about child rearing. You say in discussing the infant adult contact. I'm coming back to what you were saying about the 14-year-old girl. But one of the lines you use is, modern human mothers have acquired the suckling habits of rabbits while retaining the lactational physiology of chimpanzees and monkeys. Right? What if you could unpack that? Because,
sure.
Again, there's kind of some interesting things to discover.
Fair enough. Mother rabbits. There are some mammals differ, female mammals differ in whether they suckle essentially continuously or a few times during the day. Mother antelopes and mother rabbits, they go out and forage, and then they come back, and a few times a day they very quickly nurse the young and then go off. There are other mother animals that carry the young, and the young can nurse essentially continuously. So, for example, mother bats, they carry the baby small bat around when they're flying. And primates, mother primates carry the baby, so the baby nurses essentially continuously. We humans are primates, and our physiology is geared to virtually continuous nursing. And in fact, in hunter-gatherer societies, where the mother holds the baby nurses on demand, it nurses whenever it feels like it, including at night when the mother is sleeping. In hunter-gatherer societies, the baby will nurse quite a few times an hour for a short time. But in modern American life, it's hard to reconcile that with having a job of Secretary of State and various other things. And so that American mothers, or mothers, professional mothers in working societies, nurse as do rabbits and antelopes several times a day, but our lactational physiology is still the lactational physiology of a primate geared for continuous nursing. But that also it's a really interesting case, because it illustrates that learning from traditional societies is not a simple matter. There are some things that we can readily adopt for ourselves from traditional societies. There are some things that we can adopt individually, but with difficulty. And there are some things that we can't adopt at all as individuals, because it requires societal change. For example, if you don't like the American civil and criminal justice system, you as an individual can't do much about it. It's only the government that can do something about it. Whereas if you think that it's bad to spank babies, you can decide, I'm not going to spank my baby regardless of whether the couple next door is spanking their baby.
Well, you talk about that, and how that there is not a uniform attitude towards spanking babies in different Western societies. Can you carry that a little farther?
In Western society, as all of us who are old enough or who have traveled know, the attitude towards spanking babies varies. When I was growing up, it was considered acceptable and not only normal but required to spank babies. There are expressions such as spare the rod and spoil the child. I have British friends who still believe that the best thing to do is to smack a child quickly in order to get the child to learn something. Nowadays in Europe, spanking babies is far less acceptable than it was 50 years ago. In Sweden, it is illegal to spank a baby. In Germany, I just learned from a German friend that it is now, in fact, forbidden to practice physical punishment of a kid in Germany. But even within the United States, there are differences about spanking. Evangelicals tend to be much more into spanking than are, say, liberal Americans. And in traditional societies, herding societies tend to be more into physical punishment, because the consequences of a mistake are so severe. If the kid makes a mistake and leaves the gate open, then out go your valuable cows and pigs and sheep. Whereas in a hunter-gatherer society, where there's nothing valuable that can be destroyed, if the kid misbehaves, that's the kid's own problem. And so in hunter-gatherer societies, it's usually unacceptable to hit a baby among the pygmies of the African rainforest. If one parent hits an infant, that's considered grounds for divorce.
Well, that's, you know, related to punishment. I wonder if you can continue talking about the hunter-gatherer societies. You talk about the courage and the role that macho does or doesn't play in hunter-gatherer societies, especially among the Kung, right?
The macho attitude that's widespread in America, particularly among males, particularly among younger males, I have never encountered a macho attitude in New Guinea, partly because there's so much real danger that the last thing that you need to do is to seek out danger. And in addition, because if you make a mistake, it can't be fixed. In New Guinea, the last thing you can do is make a mistake, whereas in the United States, so I broke my foot once. I broke my foot slipping on ice in Harvard Square, and what did I do? I went staggered to a phone booth, called up my father, who was a doctor, and he come and bailed me out. In New Guinea, if you break your foot, there's not a surgeon to set it, so you'll probably end up being crippled for the rest of your life. So the macho attitudes one commonly encounters in the U.S., one doesn't encounter in New Guinea. I remember a friend of mine, a missionary family, American missionary family, who work in New Guinea. They brought up the kids in New Guinea. Finally, when the kids were teenagers, they moved back to the United States, where it was real culture shock for the kids. And I remember the boy telling me, American boys are macho. Nice kids don't do well in the United States.
So here's someone who wants to know about evolution and how that ties to what has allowed us to survive or been a recipe for success in our DNA in the past, and why that's not catching up with our lifestyles, perhaps more quickly. Absorption of salt, for example. Right? Basically, why aren't we evolving so that we don't absorb so much salt, since we eat so much more salt than traditional societies? Yeah,
that's a big question for physicians and evolutionary biologists. Why do our bodies do things that are obviously bad for us? For example, why are our bodies so efficient at absorbing salt when our problem with salt is to get rid of it rather than to absorb it? Or why are our bodies so efficient at laying down fat when for most Americans our problem is in fact avoiding laying down fat rather than laying down fat? The reason here is that our bodies, the bodies that we've got today, are bodies that were adapted to conditions of the last 6 million years, and natural selection with the change in our lifestyle has not been rapid enough to weed out the genes that were good for us in the past but are bad for us today. For example, the genes that permit us to absorb salt were great for most of human history when there were no salt shakers. Now, in modern times, we have salt shakers. Those genes that let you absorb salt end up causing hypertension and stroke. And in fact, what is happening is that the genes associated with diseases such as diabetes and hypertension are in some populations gradually getting weeded out of the population by the deaths of the people carrying those genes, but that's a slow matter.
So what are some of the populations where that's happened?
Well, a prime example of a population where natural selection has been observed or inferred in modern times. And this may in fact be a good wrap-up question because it's such a nice example. There's, in the United States, but not in Europe, debate about the validity of evolution and natural selection, which is on a par of debating whether the world is round or flat. But nevertheless, the majority of American college biology graduate majors do not believe in evolution. And now I've gotten so wound up on that. Could you remind me what was the question that I was going to ask? Oh, an example, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So a prime example after that emotional outburst. The island of Nauru in the Pacific Ocean is a traditional island of Micronesian people who had a Spartan lifestyle and worked hard, and they prized p- people who were plumper, but they rarely got the opportunity to get plump. And then Nauru phosphate was discovered on Nauru. Phosphate was mined. The royalties came into Nauru. Nauru became one of the richest countries in the world on a per capita basis by the phosphate royalties. And nowadays, Nauruans, instead of fishing and plowing their crops and being physically vigorous, Nauruans go to the supermarket and they shovel in the food. And Nauruans are something like twice the weight of Australians of the same height. And Nauruans have the highest incidence of type 2 diabetes of any people in the world. Why? Because Nauruans evolved in a Spartan lifestyle, as did many other people. And then two things happened to them. They suddenly were plunged into the First World lifestyle within literally a decade. And during the Second World War, the population of Nauru was taken away by the Japanese military. Half of them starved to death. The half who survived were the ones with the most efficient metabolism, which is great if you're being starved to death by the Japanese military, but it's terrible when you're eating in supermarkets. And so in Nauru today, few Nauruans survive till age 70, and of those who do survive to age 70, 70% have type 2 diabetes. But within the last decade or two, the incidence of diabetes in Nauru has dropped, not because the lifestyle conditions have changed, but because those people carrying the genes disposing you towards diabetes in Nauru are dying off and not leaving children. So that's a case of natural selection under our eyes, so much for creationists. Good note on which to end.
Well, we actually have, if you're able to say, we have a few more minutes if we're able to keep going for the radio broadcast.
Let's keep going after
all
that
right.
Emotional outburst.
All right. Great. Well, actually, kind of following up on that, because you talk about hypertension and stress and in the book you talk about obviously that being one of the real problems that we face in contemporary society. Of course, when you've worked in New Guinea, right, you have to be completely unplugged. There's no cell phone or anything when you've been up in when you're doing work up in the highlands, for example. What about when you're back in the States? Do you ever intentionally unplug when you're in LA or in the Bitterroot Valley?
No, as my friends here know, I never intentionally unplug because I never plug in the first place. I do not know how to use those wretched cell phones. No, I do have a cell phone which makes calls but doesn't receive them. I do not know how to operate a computer. As Ronald Reagan said, my feet are set in concrete and I will not learn to use the wretched thing. So I never unplug.
Well, here's someone in the audience who wants to know, in talking about tribal societies, if you could discuss women marrying into other tribes and the adoption of children by other tribes with respect to genetic diversity and cross-tribal relationships.
Sure. Two things there. Women marrying into other tribes. It is common for tribal societies to be what's called exogamous, which means that you don't marry someone in your village, you marry someone in another village. That has genetic advantages, although the tribal people wouldn't know about it. It also has political advantages in that marrying someone from another group builds political alliances within the neighboring group.
So within your work in New Guinea, I'm wondering if you could share a story which is one of the most harrowing parts of the book, where you talk about encountering an unknown figure outside your tent at night.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of these near-death experiences. To coming back to the larger points you're making in the book about risk.
In my book, I have two chapters about dangers, and one introduces the subject of danger by three stories of what were or could have been some of the most dangerous things that happened to me in New Guinea. And then the second chapter is a chapter that considers dangers around the world and compares the traditional attitude towards danger with the modern American attitude towards danger. The episode that you're referring to occurred early in my experience in New Guinea, in one of the early years, when I and a batch of New Guineans were on a several-day hike to another village where I wanted to study birds. It was an area that was now not populated. It was an area that had been brought under control relatively recently. So we set out from a village for another village, several days' walk away. And I think on the first or second night out, It had been a grueling day. There wasn't a trail. We were instead following a river torrent. It was raining all day. And finally, exhausted, we pitched our camps in the forest, not in this uninhabited forest. My New Guineans slept in one tent. I was sleeping in another tent nearby, and I fell asleep. And I woke up during the night because I heard there were footsteps outside my tent. Nothing alarming about that. I thought that one of the New Guineans had gone out to relieve himself. And at the time, it struck me, but it's strange, why did he come to relieve himself by going around my tent instead of going in the opposite direction? Why does he come near my tent? And I heard the footsteps. But New Guineans do things that I didn't understand, so I started to doze off. Then I heard the sounds of voices from the tent with my New Guineans, and I could see the light of the fire blazing up brightly. So I shouted out, "Let's go to sleep," and that was that. No other warning. No signs of danger. Until the next morning, I asked the New Guineans, "So what's going on?" And the New Guinean said, "We woke up at night, and we saw in this uninhabited area forest, there was a man standing at the entrance to the tent, holding out his arm like this with his wrist drooping." And in New Guinea, that gesture, the wrist drooping, is the sign of the big New Guinea flightless bird, the cassowary, which kills people. And magicians imitate that motion of the cassowary lowering its head to charge, to show their power. So my New Guineans were afraid, and they shouted out and lit up the fire, and the man ran off. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't attach any significance to it. The next day, I proceeded to do something that, in retrospect, was extremely stupid and dangerous. Namely, I was eager to watch birds, so I walked on ahead, leaving my New Guineans behind, and walked on ahead for several hours in this beautiful forest watching birds. Eventually, my New Guineans caught up. I was alone. They caught up with me. And I didn't think anything more about it until I came back to the village from which we had started out, when people told me, in that uninhabited area forest where people used to be, people moved into villages some years ago, but there's one crazy guy, and really crazy by New Guinea standards, they said. We recognize him as crazy, who's still living in that forest, and he's dangerous. He's killed people. He killed one of his sons because the son didn't eat a banana, ate a banana that the father didn't want him to eat. He killed a couple of his wives, and he's killed people coming through the forest. So evidently what had happened was that this crazy guy heard or saw us marching through, saw what was obviously a European tent. It was one of these Eureka Pop tents, tried to get into the tent to go after the European inside the tent. But any of you who know a Eureka Pop tent know that the door zipped up, looks like the window zipped up, so the guy couldn't figure out which was the way into the tent. So he came around the back to look for the door, but it wasn't the door, it was the window. Came around the other side when he was spotted. And in retrospect, if he had found me, I'm sure his intentions were not good. And the next day, when I was walking on alone, if he had found me, I would probably not be having this discussion with you. But that was early in my New Guinea career when I was young and ignorant.
Well, this person wants to know if you could comment on your earlier remark about the 49-51% chances of surviving. And along with that, there's a question, why should one get a degree in geography?
Why should one get a degree in geography? A way of summing it up is that if you are meeting a person about whom you know nothing, and you want as quickly as possible to find out the most possible from that person, but you're only permitted to ask the person two questions with one-word answers. What are the two questions with one-word answers to ask someone if you want to understand the person as much as possible? And one can debate about this, but my answer would be, two questions to ask would be, where were you born and when were you born? Because if the answer is, I was born in Poland in 1937, or I was born in the United States in 1937, or I was born in the United States in 1968, right away you know whether that person was probably orphaned or got an education or the person's political views. So that's a short way of saying that's why we need to understand geography. And for the United States nowadays, I'd say geography is a life or death matter for the survival of the United States, as well as for the survival of the world.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Diamond. I hope that you've enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. And again, we'd like to thank Dr. Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA and author of The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. And thanks to our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio and on the web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating more than 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
You want to mention the book signing?